If you want this podcast free of ads, follow us now on patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Economic indicators.
Who knows where this is going to end up?
To understand the economy, you have to understand human nature.
This podcast is powered by Acast.
How are you there? It is podcast time. Lots and lots and lots going on. But you know what we're going to do today? We're going to try and put some flesh on the bones of a lot of that good talk in Glasgow about climate change, etc. And we're going to look at some practical examples of what countries can do to accelerate, number one, their responsible position with respect to the environment. And, John, to measure the thing, how are you, Ed?
I'm very good. I'm very good.
Going back to your favourite place. Just to tell you, you go for a pint with this guy. You're watching the football. And he said, you see things like you're watching United, who I know, fairness to United fans, are up and down. And he'll say things like, do you know Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is Norwegian?
I never said that in my life.
I said, I don't give a shite.
I didn't even know that.
Whether he is or not. So just bear
anyway,
with me.
I had a very good, what are those kind of trips that politicians go on?
Junkets.
Junkets and exploratory.
Exploratory, yeah.
So that's what I did.
On your large political expense account. But we have somebody who's come up with, John met him in Norway, and we got to speak to him the other night. And it's a fantastic idea, which is something really practical, John.
Yeah.
It's called a climate change budget. And that's Oslo, which John has now been given the free man of the city for his al fresco promotion. Okay, shameless promotion of Oslo. His name is Gaute Hegerup. He is in charge of a fascinating, the Norwegian chapter, they're like Hell's Angels, the Norwegian chapter of a intercity movement called C40. And he's also responsible for what they call the climate budget in a climate change budget in Oslo. So let's go to the freezing north where John feels at home, to Norway. We are now going to Oslo. You will not, if you're listening to the podcast, be unaware that John went to Norway a couple of weeks ago. In fact, he hasn't stopped talking about Norway. He's the brand ambassador for Norway in Ireland. He's on a retainer in high-end kronas from the Norwegian sovereign.
I'm planning on going back very soon.
The Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is spending a fortune on keeping their fine consultant, John Davis, in a propaganda role saying Norway is fab. But we are going to Norway because one of the people that John heard about but didn't meet is Gaute Hegerup, who is part of and policy director of an extraordinary and frankly an organization that Irish cities should be part of called C40, which is cities thinking about climate change, about sustainability, about policies to make our cities leading edge contributors to reducing our carbon footprint, number one, and solving, or at least going some way towards solving climate change. Gaute, how are you?
Great.
Okay, so just so you know.
Thank you. Nice. Thanks for inviting me.
Not at all. So you know, we have a Norwegian fan over here. Next, he's going to be listening to Viking heavy metal.
Already am.
And it's all good. Exactly. Gaute, I am fascinated by this organization that you are a member of. Tell me exactly what the organization is.
Well, C40 is the world's largest climate network for megacities of the world. 97 cities are members, and they are among the biggest cities in the world. They, in all altogether, the 10% of the people on the planet live in these cities. 25% of the world's GDP is produced in these cities. And the membership of a C40 city in the network is carried by the mayor of the city. So it has very strong political buy-in. And the goal of the of all the cities and the goal of the network is to make all these cities do 1.5 degrees Paris Agreement targets implemented in their city. So making all these mayors and all these cities do their part of the 1.5 degree Paris Agreement target.
Now, the extraordinary thing is that no Irish city, we can come back to that, but it's worth reiterating for our audience in particular, not one Irish city is a member of this. It shows two things, I think, and we can talk about this in a little while. Number one is the fact that Irish cities do not have sufficient centralized power. Irish power is all centralized in the government. They are terrified of having directly elected mayors and our decentralized power, whether it's tax raising or whether it's policy implementing, but you need to have both, really. That's number one. So even if an Irish city mayor did rock up, it would be more cosmetic than real. And the second thing I also think is maybe we're not taking this as seriously as we should. But Gauda, tell me what sort of initiatives are orchestrated at the C40 level and how do they percolate down before I talk about Oslo itself?
Well, the cities, the whole idea here is that the cities need to learn from each other. We have very short time towards 2030, or we had short time to save the planet to reach the 1.5 degree target. So here is, it's a question of steal with pride, copy paste, find the solution that works best in any city and paste, copy paste it in your own city and scale it up. It's a scaling machine. It's a copy paste machine. It's about cities learning from one another. That's the whole idea. And it's a broad range of activities. I mean, it's about transportation, it's about buildings, energy efficiency, it's about air quality, and now lately, of course, also post-COVID, green and just recovery. So the whole thing here is that mayors learn from each other and city administrations, city bureaucrats learn best practice from each other.
Now, can I ask you about Oslo? Is the Oslo mayor directly elected and has executive powers? Can I ask you how it's structured just before we talk about the what's going on in Oslo?
Yes, he is. The people elect for the parties and the parties select their mayor.
Okay, but the mayor has tax-raising powers within Oslo itself?
Yes.
And so therefore they have a budget internally that they can say, okay, we're going to deploy this budget here or there. So the buck does actually stop with the mayor. If you're an Oslo citizen, if you're the average Osloer and you're knocking around and you're fed up about something or you think that we could do something better here or whatever, you know that the buck stops with the mayor. Is that the case?
Yeah, you can elect those politicians that would allocate resources the way you would like it to be allocated.
Okay, so so it's kind of ring-fenced because here in Ireland, we've got this...
It's partly. I mean, of course, there's a lot of stately money as well.
Sure, sure.
But the municipal money, they have authority over some parts of their own budget. Absolutely.
Okay. Now, one thing I was fascinated was this idea of a carbon budget. Explain this to me because this is something that Oslo is doing. What is it? It seems to be highly effective in zeroing in at responsibility. So explain this to me.
Yeah, it's a really, really interesting concept they have developed in Oslo called the climate budget. And the whole idea is that it shifts the focus from the long-term targets, the visions that most cities and nations have, 2030, 2040, 2050, even some 2060. Can you believe that? Okay. If we are going to save the planet, we need to bring this down to much shorter term. We need to talk about what are we going to do in 2022, 23, 24. In order to reach those long-term targets. Oslo has a very ambitious target of cutting CO2 emissions to 95% by 2030. That gives a trajectory line from now on until then, which is quite steep. And that makes it possible for them to do the math and calculate down on annual level what we need to cut. So what they've started to do is they've started to creating budgets like we create the fiscal budget with the monetary. In Norway, it's the kroner. In your country, is the euro, I guess.
Yep.
So they made a parallel budget with CO2 at the end instead of the NOK, which is the Norwegian kroner. So the whole idea here is to do the math, calculate down what needs to be cut year, list the biggest emission sources in the city, get it in like a budget and see who needs to cut what and where.
So for example, in a city like Dublin and most Irish cities, I'd say it's transport and construction are the two big polluters in the city. How are you dealing with them in Oslo?
One thing which is important here is that it is no longer the climate and environment department's responsibility to make it happen. They are the advisors who calculate it, but then it's the mayor of finance who makes this implemented in the organization. Because if it's one thing we know, it's that the best placed person in an organization to make everyone jump when he says jump, it's the CFO.
Yes, exactly.
The CFO creates the budgets. So the CFO in the city of Oslo creates both the fiscal budget and the CO2 budget. But the CO2 budget is on the advice from the sustainability department, and they have calculated how much the transportation department needs to cut. And so the CFO writes it into the budget that this is needs to be cut.
So this amazed me. Let's take something like construction. So Dublin, I'm not sure about Oslo. I was there a couple of years ago. I haven't been there for a while. Gorgeous city, and we can talk about it for a long time. But John, of course, will embellish.
Beautiful city.
Anyway, what I want to talk about, let's say you take construction. Dublin's going through this big construction boom, stupidly, I think, in offices when we need to build houses, but that's for another day. Would it be the case that, for example, you would say to a developer, okay, you can build this 10-story building and la, 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 but you need to be compliant with your carbon budget. And if you are not compliant, you don't get planning permission.
Yes. And that's exactly what has happened in Oslo, which is a really interesting story, because they calculated down the emissions sources and found out, okay, construction machinery is a really big sinner in the city. And so they said in the public procurement, they spread out to the companies that you can only get this contract if you can do the job with either emission-free or fossil-free machinery. And this is an interesting story because they responded positively. They said, thank you for challenging us on that. We would love to have that machinery, but it doesn't exist.
This is like an electric. This isn't like an electric digger or an electric crane. Or
at the time in 2016, it didn't exist. But then they agreed. The private sector said to the city of Oslo, "If you will keep this in your procurement and just give us a couple of years, we will for sure develop solutions." And then 3 years later, in 2019, the first electrical digger was made, and then the world's first complete emission-free construction site was in place in Oslo.
Wow.
And this is due to the public procurement that Oslo pushed. And now there are more than 100 electric diggers in the market in Oslo. And it's rising. It's becoming more and more popular to buy electric diggers because it's needed in order to get a public contract.
That is amazing. And can I just ask you just about private contracts too? Because, okay, you've got the public contract. Let's say the state wants to build, you know, whatever, a building or a block of flats or whatever. In terms of the private, let's say, is it also a stipulation of private building that you need to be carbon neutral?
Well, yeah, here is, to be honest, the development of the climate budget in Oslo is still in progress.
Okay.
And we have so far controlled our own agencies and our own procurements and our own special planning and policy makings. But we are in dialogue also with the private sector in the city that, you know, trying to push them to also start procuring with the same demand. And of course, they are really geared up to this. So I think we'll see that coming. But for the time being, it's more like a dialogue to make them follow suit. But of course, this is public sector needs to be the pushy part here, because this is how you make innovation happen, by using your public procurement muscle to demand new solutions.
And tell me about electric cars, because again, when I live beside a part of the street, which is a bus station in Dunleary, a small part outside Dublin. But we have like, we usually have about five or six big buses revving up all day. Fellas and girls having smokes, the drivers outside having a chat, leaving the engines on. And although Dublin has made great strides in the types of buses, they're still pretty noxious things, right? They're still belching out fumes, okay? What have you done in public transport over there?
Well, it's the same story actually on the transportation agency. They've started procuring electrical buses. They've also started to use biodiesel. But this is an interesting thing though, because here is where the city and the nation collides a little bit, because national law has made it more expensive with biodiesel, which is totally against what the city of Oslo wants. But this is just one of many examples of how cities in many ways are more progressive than nation states. And that's the same case in Norway. I mean, Oslo wants more than the national government of Norway is able to allow them to.
Is this because you're an oil producer?
I don't want to go down that lane right now, but yes, perhaps. I don't know.
Do you have censorship in Norway? Oh my God, do you have Norwegian oil police? But I presume it is. You produce lots of oil, so you're conflicted. You want to be nice, but the pounds, shilling and pence say, hold on a second, we've got to keep producing. Eventually Norway will have to choose.
We will, definitely. And that's a really headache here in the country. Absolutely. You know, so many people work in the oil and petrol business, and we need to cut it. But it's really, really hard for a Norwegian government to do that.
It's kind of like being in the slavery business. You know, it's kind of unethical. Yeah. It's getting smelly, but you used to make lots of money off it. But I mean, that is a big dilemma for Norway.
It is. For us working in the climate business like I do, it's really a headache to sit there and watch that we just have a government now that still are open to search for new oil fields. And they try to save themselves by saying that, well, we will do much research on green solutions in parallel. And yeah.
Well, you see, this is always amazed me about Ireland. I could understand Irish national policy if we had the biggest oil fields in Europe off the coast of Galway. I could understand Irish national policy if we, for example, produced cars. Ireland hasn't produced a car ever. We've assembled for Ford many years ago. So in a bizarre way, we have a country that should be accelerating profoundly its renewables because in actual fact, we have wind energy because A, we don't produce oil and B, we don't produce trucks or cars or anything. So the value added for Ireland in every new car sold in this country is zero. It's actually zero. In actual fact, it's negative. Mm-hmm. And yet we don't have an aggressive green agenda, which makes no sense to me as an economist at all. In the Norwegian sense, I can understand you're a bit conflicted because you've got all this stuff gushing out of the North Atlantic and into your back pockets and into your sovereign wealth fund, etc. Can I just conclude on this issue, though, of cities being leaders? Because it has always been the case that the metropolis has led in every area. It's always intellectually more interesting, morally more interesting, sexually more interesting, politically more interesting. The metropolis, since the Greeks placed the agora in the center of their society, has been the place that things happen. How do you think cities are going to look like in the future? And the reason I say this is because the relationship between the city and the nation state, as you've just highlighted, can actually end up being quite a fractious one.
Mm. Well, I think that what I see happening in all the C40 cities is a tremendous job being done to transform them to more livable cities, where the idea of making more greener zones, making more what we call the 15-minute city, where you can have access to both to all your needs within walking and biking distance. I mean, it's going to take time to transform because it's the way you build a city, and much of the infrastructure is already built. But it is, as you say, it's a really transformative wave in so many ways in the cities of the world that I think we're going to see a huge transformation in the next 20, 30, 40 years, to be honest.
I think you're right. I mean, if you think that in around 1910 or 1915, the world was hijacked by the carbon industry and the car industry. and architects and city planners and town planners all genuflected to the car. And that was the history of the last 100 years. So it took 100 years to change our urban landscape into what it looks like now. And it may well take 50 more years to change back.
Absolutely. It's going to take years because it's already built. But I mean, you see so many examples of cities now just repainting lanes in the streets to biking, and so many even taking away cars and putting in trees and plants on top of what it would used to be a car street. So there are absolutely actions possible to take in the already existing built environment.
Well, I tell you what we'll do, Gauta, we will leave it there, but we'll be coming back. Gauta, it's great to talk to you. Take care.
Same to you. See Thanks you. A lot.
Bye.
You know, it's interesting, Mac, that, and we spoke about this before, about mayoral cities and having a directly elected mayor with a budget, with some power.
Yeah.
And we don't have that in Ireland. And C40 is a great example of how effective city mayors can be.
No, you're absolutely right. And also it's city mayors who, as you said, are elected, so they're answerable to the people, but also have executive power so they can actually do something.
Yeah.
Because you remember years ago, and actually it's a fascinating discussion. You remember living in London years and years ago.
I do.
And Ken Livingstone was the mayor.
I do,
and the
yeah.
GLC
yeah,
was
yeah.
the operational hub of the city.
Yeah.
And Margaret Thatcher went against the GLC. Why? To take away their executive powers.
Yeah.
So the mayor would be nothing but a ceremonial figure, which we have had here. I mean, I have no... Do you know who the Dublin mayor is?
It's your one...
Your one Hume. M. Don't even Google it. You don't know. So obviously we don't know. But John, you're absolutely right. But one other thing on mayors was interesting talking to Gauta there is you can have all these targets. How do you measure them?
Well, exactly. And it's interesting you should say that, David.
Right, it's laid up to you. Do you know what they say in football? I'll just cross it, you knock it in. All right.
But actually, the person who I met over there, Claire McAree, she heads up and just launched, actually, the Irish-Norwegian Chamber of Commerce. And the whole purpose of that is to bring Irish and Norwegian companies together, both public and private, for more collaboration, particularly with an eye on sustainability and green solutions. And one of those companies that she introduced me to was Cognite. And I spoke with Paula Doyle. She's an Irish woman. And Cognite are a Norwegian tech company, a software company. And they specialize in data, big data, and analyzing it for the purpose of making industry and industrial processes a lot more efficient and sustainable. And they work with all sorts of different industry sectors across the world, including oil and gas. But anyway, I started the conversation by asking her, how achievable does she think the green transition goals and carbon emission goals, how achievable are they in reality?
So I think the goals, they're certainly ambitious. And I believe that we're going to have to do things a lot differently than we do today to achieve them. You know, it's not just technology to the point, although that is an extremely important point, but it's also everything around the commercialization and the scale up of renewable energy. That is absolutely key. And that means that we need to ensure that companies who are developing renewable products or just operating in that space are really supported by regulatory factors or whatever needs to be put in place to enable them to commercialize and scale their operations.
So is the answer to sustainability tech?
Yes, it is. 100%. Technology is, as has always been the case through time with human, technology and innovation is what's going to drive us forward. And I think, you know, from Cognite's perspective, because we are a very data-centered company, we say that sustainability is a data problem.
Explain that to me.
Well, basically, you know, how on earth can you make sustainable choices if you don't see what's going on?
Mm-hmm.
So how do you optimize how do you reduce your energy usage, for example? How do you optimize your emissions if you're not able to have access to your data and you're not able to apply kind of like machine learning and artificial intelligence to that data in a way that you can then trust it to make the operational decisions. And right now, people just, they struggle with access to the data. And of course, it's also a lot around, you know, if you can't measure it, like, how do you improve it? Right. So it's about being able to measure correctly as well. And this is for sure, like, this is where the industry is going, because if you see kind of in the past, you could ride a wave with visionary statements from industry around, you know, yes, we're going to reduce our emissions. Yes, you know, we're on our path. But really, we're very kind of rapidly moving into the point where it needs to be proven. So that means that we need to have the data, we need to be able to show measurements, and we need to be able to kind of measure change. That's how we can have a serious scaled up impact on greenhouse gas emissions.
But given that Norway is such a huge oil and gas giant, how do you reconcile that with sustainability?
It's easy kind of to sit on the outside and be very black and white about it, but this is an extremely complex, interconnected energy system that we're talking about here. And the truth of it is, like, whatever way you look at the energy mix, oil and gas is going to be a part of it for the foreseeable future, because we are just not able to deliver the supply needed today without it. So what we have to do, what is the responsible thing to do, is not to just, you know, ignore oil and gas, but it's actually to work with that industry so that they can produce as sustainably as possible, while also doing everything we can to accelerate the renewable space.
Can you give us some examples of how you use data to optimize efficiency for sustainability?
I mean, I can give so many examples, but basically we're using data to reduce energy consumption. We're using data to kind of optimize, like, turbines, which are kind of CO2 emitters, so that they will have less CO2. We're using data to reduce the raw materials required into processes so that it's actually less usage. And we're using data to optimize maintenance, which maybe doesn't sound directly linked to sustainability, but it's all about reducing spare parts. And it's just amazing what you can do when you turn that around and you get that data coming in, and you can make decisions based on the actual reality and being able to, you know, and also that your prediction of the reality too. I think the truth is with the oil and gas industry today, and it's so important for oil and gas companies to produce as sustainably and efficiently as possible. And I'm in no doubt that it's only those who will do that will survive.
But can we achieve those targets, those emission targets, through optimization alone?
I think we can do a lot with optimization, to be perfectly honest. But at the same time, we need to accelerate the rate of adoption of renewable power. So industry needs to be powered more by renewable energy. It's a lot of things that need to not fall into place, that need to be forced into place for us to have a chance of hitting those targets. But they are extremely ambitious, and 2030 is really close. You know, there's a race on. I think companies need to think really smartly about how can they be forerunners in that race, and kind of to the point where not everyone can do everything on their own, right? So it's kind of about these kind of clever collaborations really driving forward. And that's a lot around kind of industrial companies. It's a lot around kind of tech companies as well. It's kind of big players and small startups. It's, you know, to navigate this space where you have potential competitors, potential partners, but you kind of need to work together. I think this is the challenge of our times.
And have you seen this kind of shift in mentality and approach within industry?
Absolutely. You know, we commissioned a study with Axios and Harris Poll on this. So we surveyed a lot of industry and energy leaders around kind of their attitudes to sustainability. And it was 93% of them said that tech is like the immediate part of the solution. What the report says is actually what I experience as well, kind of talking to like leaders of industry from around the world. And we had our industrial conference on earlier this week, and all of these C-level attendees. And then we had a large number of industrial leaders kind of from Norway and from Europe. And the common thread that emerged that was not planned or scheduled was collaboration. I think every single leader that sat on that stage talked about the importance of collaboration. And this is a huge shift I've never seen. And we see it in the dialogues we have as well. I've never seen collaboration being talked about at this level. And like, there's very interesting collaborations going on here in Norway around carbon capture and around other renewables. So it's really exciting to see it in action. But it's really about like that, this urgency to move from talk to action. Like that is, that shines through in that report. And also kind of their acknowledgement of what it's going to take to get there as well. You know, they do know what's needed, you know, in terms of like data, in terms of tech. They do know they need to be action oriented. Like I think everyone's seeing the writing on the walls for actual, you know, sustainability metrics.
So how do you force this change? I mean, is it through regulation, or is it through the market, or is it through customer demand?
You know, it's so important to get the incentives lined up, right? So if we just talk about sustainability from an ivory tower perspective, then what happens? But if we talk about sustainability, and sustainability is 100% linkable to the bottom line. It absolutely is. And not only that, but also like these other things like access to capital, which is just massive, right? But sustainability is very easily linked to the bottom line. And I think that is absolutely how it should be, because we want industry to use less raw material. We want them to produce, you know, higher quality. We want less waste. We want things to be as optimal as possible. And there's two outcomes from that, one of which becomes cheaper to run. And then the second one is that it's just far better for the environment.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
So that was Paula Doyle from Cognite in Norway, and a huge thanks to her for giving me her time.
Interesting enough stuff, part of me. I mean, first thing is, I've always, you know, I like statistics.
Yes.
Like all that sort of stuff.
Number cruncher.
I know. And I actually feel that, you know, the sign of a civilized society is a society with good statistics.
Yeah.
Not good poetry, not great literature, but good statistics, because you measure things. And then once you start measuring, you start thinking about a certain way, comparing. You could also compare the past with the future. You can set targets. It's a way of actually thinking about the world.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So I, you know, I think all big data, all good. However, do you remember what Rob was saying last week about the company with the biggest data doesn't make the best decisions? That company, Zillow. The data on the housing market doesn't make the best decisions.
They're just in the wrong business.
Well, that's probably true. So no, so I'm persuaded by the data simply because it reflects the sort of subset brain that I have that likes all these little subsets of data and econometrics and all that stuff. But that's...
Next time, stick on your duffel coat and come with me over to Norway.
I will. Me duffel coat, me Arsenal bag. I'll be there. See you next week.
Just before you go, thank you all very much for supporting us on Patreon. And also, if you don't support us on Patreon and you want to learn economics, we have this fantastic new course, which has a video element, it has an audio element, it has all the reading lists, it has notes, it has all sorts of bizarre and unusual takes from the world of economics. It's called International Trade and Money. First three lectures are Humanomics, which is about putting humanity back into economics. Second lecture is The Trading Ape, the idea that we are actually hardwired to trade. And the third is the myth of barter. And of course, this is a 14-lecture series taking us all the way up to crypto. If you want to learn economics, join me on Patreon, patreon.com/David McWilliams.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're concerned about mental health or looking to get into self-improvement, join me at the Piece by Piece podcast. There, I'm interviewing everyday people and experts alike about how to overcome difficulties around mental health. Speaking of which, I just released an interview with a mental health historian and another with two friends who are healthcare workers.
If these conversations interest you, check us out at Piece by Piece. That's Piece with an A, B-I, and then Piece with an I. Thank you so much.